Support for IPR and this podcast comes from Central College and Humanities Iowa, presenting the new podcast Mid-Americana, Stories from a Changing Midwest. New episodes from Season 1 are available at midamericana.com or wherever podcasts are found.
It's Talk of Iowa from Iowa Public Radio. I'm Charity Nebbe. Later this hour, Ambassador Kenneth Quinn, who's been president of the World Food Prize organization for the last 20 years, is stepping down. We will meet Barbara Stinson, the woman who will be taking his place. But first, the new children's book, Amazing Iowa Athletes, an A to Z illustrated guide to some of Iowa's most extraordinary athletes, has just been published by Raygun. The book tells the stories of Iowa athletes past and present, but it goes beyond just their athletic achievements. Readers will definitely learn about athletes they've never heard of, maybe even a couple of sports they've not heard of. They'll learn more about athletes whose names they know as well. Author Katie Swalwell is here, and in a few minutes, we'll also meet a couple of amazing Iowa athletes. Mountain climber Jen Loeb, the first Iowa woman to ever climb Mount Everest, and figure skater Timothy LeDuc, who along with his partner won the 2019 Pair National Championships and the 2019 World Team Trophy Championships. They'll be here in just a moment. But first, Katie Swalwell is associate professor in the School of Education at Iowa State University. This is her second book for children. It's a follow-up to Amazing Iowa Women. Hello, Katie.
Hello, Charity. How are you?
Great. Thank you so much for being here.
Thanks for having me. It's my pleasure.
So tell me why you wanted to tackle athletes.
Yes. A lot of my friends and family are asking because I'm not a super athletic person myself. But when the team at Raygun and I were talking about which volume we wanted to come next in the series, we thought that focusing on athletics would tap a different group of kids who maybe don't think that they're necessarily super interested in history. As a history lover, I think they're wrong. I think they just don't know yet. So we were thinking that by having a focus on sports and athletics, we'd be able to cast an even wider net and bring more people into this really fantastic series of history biographies.
Now, of course, a lot of Iowans are sports fans, and we are really good at adopting anybody who plays any sport in Iowa as an Iowan, right?
It's true.
What kind of qualifications does an athlete have to be considered an Iowa athlete in your book?
That's a great question. Yes, there are definitely a few athletes who were not born here, who maybe were recruited by a university or a college to play here. Really anyone who spent time and who accomplished great things in their sport while they were in Iowa, those were people that I included. And then, of course, people who were born here, who were raised here, who maybe went elsewhere and accomplished things. But I feel like Iowans are good at claiming those people, too.
Yes, so, we are.
Yep, I really wanted to cast the net pretty wide. And honestly, I was thinking a lot, and this was true for the first book, Amazing Iowa Women, wanting to make sure that any person, any child who picks up this book will be able to see themselves represented. So just making sure that it's a really diverse, in all sorts of ways, book, especially because it's illustrated, that kids can really see themselves represented. And so that helped me expand maybe, my definition of who counts as an Iowan. But I think everyone who's in the book has a deep connection and love for Iowa, for sure.
Well, and there are some very high profile Iowa athletes that I think people would assume would be part of this book. And they are. Their names are mentioned in the book, but they're not the highlights of the book. People like Bob Feller, Dan Gable, Niall Kinnick, they sort of are part of the footnotes. So tell me a little bit more about that. Were you trying to look at for stories that haven't gotten as much attention?
Exactly. I hope that doesn't turn anybody off. If they don't have Niall Kinnick on the cover, I won't buy the book. But
there are several books with Niall Kinnick on the cover, so you can buy one of those instead.
I think that's exactly what I was thinking, that I really wanted this book to teach people things. And if you only ever talk about the people you already know and love, then you really aren't expanding. So I wanted to make sure I honored them and included mention of a lot of those people. But I really wanted to dig deeper and make sure that everyone who reads the book takes away something new and something different. There are a few people who I think are familiar characters, but I think their stories, maybe pieces of those stories don't often get told. And so those were people that I made sure I included and featured. But yeah, I think some of those sort of classic greats are classic greats for a reason, because people tend to know a lot about them. And there's also, I mean, especially when you talk about baseball, let's say, in Iowa, or wrestling, there's such a deep bench of incredible people that I couldn't possibly include everyone. And so I really wanted to focus on those stories that were maybe lesser known, but really fascinating.
You also went out of your way to include sports that don't immediately come to mind. I guess the last athlete alphabetically that is talked about in the book is Shenandoah's Zach Kirk, who is a mixed martial arts fighter. So that's not something that most people would have thought, oh, right, mixed martial arts. That's one of the sports that we know athletes for.
Yeah, and I think with MMA especially, this is a sport I'm relatively new to. My husband really likes to watch it, but I think the more that I dug into it, there are actually a lot of Iowans who've contributed to the popularity of this sport. It's an incredibly popular sport and on the rise, and especially because of Iowa's deep wrestling tradition, there have been camps here and a lot of athletes that have done very well in mixed martial arts, and I really wanted to make sure that I wasn't just, again, clinging to the classic sport. I think another example is probably Ultimate Frisbee gets a shout out here. I think that sport is really exciting and interesting because it is so new. It was really invented in the 1970s by high school students, which I think is really interesting in and of itself, and then took off and spread across college campuses. And then a team at Iowa State ended up becoming incredibly successful. And one thing I like about that sport as well is that it's one of the few sports that's intentionally co-ed. Most sports end up being really segregated by gender. And so I think that's kind of a neat sport to feature, too.
And having interviewed you on many topics over the years, Katie, there were a couple things that I thought, oh, that's so Katie. For example, your profile of the Kwaskis.
Oh, I love the Kwaskis.
Of course you do. I knew it. Tell us a little bit about the Kwaskis.
I love it. And the portrait, too. I should shout out that just like Amazing Iowa Women, all of the illustrations are done by Iowa artists, just an incredible group of people. And this is Maggie Bland's art, and she did such a fantastic job. And it's this called Kitten Ball, which eventually became softball, kind of evolved into softball. And it was a team in the 1930s during the Great Depression that ended up winning, I think, close to 100 games. Maybe out of 100 games, they only lost one. They were incredibly popular. They would have they were from Quasqueton, I think I'm saying that right. I hope so. And would have thousands of people come to see their games. They would take hayrack rides to get to their games. Just a really, if you like the movie A League of Their Own, I think you'll love learning about the Kwaskis. Just a really incredible group of women. Only played for 1 year, and then their coach became ill, and so they disbanded. But really inspired by the stories of that team and what they were able to do in a small town during the Depression.
Well, we have a couple of amazing Iowa athletes that you profiled in the book who are with us this hour, and I want to introduce the first one. But before I actually talk to her, I want to give you a chance to talk about her. Mountain climber Jen Loeb is the first Iowa woman to ever summit Mount Everest. That was in 2016. She's also a seven summits seeker, trying to climb all seven of the highest peaks in the world. She has only one left, Vinson Massif in Antarctica. She grew up in Jessup, Iowa, and now lives in Marengo and works at General Mills. And she isn't alphabetically featured in your book. She's in the prologue. She's the very first athlete we read about. So, Katie, why did you pick Jen?
I'm glad you noticed that, because I think of all the stories, Jen's really inspires me so much, because she, you know, here's this person who is growing up in the country in rural Iowa, about as far away from a mountain as you probably could be. And the fact that she had this dream and accomplished it, and I hope you ask her more about how she trains. I think it's really fascinating. I was just personally so inspired. And I think that her story and who she is and what she's done with her life and how athletics has allowed her to see the world and to give back all over the world really sets the tone for the book, and I hope inspires people to not ever write themselves off because they're from a small town or because they're from Iowa, or for any reason, that they're really you know, her story is really incredible. So I was very excited to have that as the prologue.
Well, and Jen, welcome to the show.
Thank you. Thank you for having me.
Well, and Jen, you and I talked back in 2016 after you got back from climbing Everest.
Yeah.
And so you've been on this journey for a very long time, but let's go back. When did you first fall in love with climbing mountains?
Well, I've always really loved the great outdoors, even as a child. You know, I was the little kid that was out running crazy all over the farm. I was climbing the trees. I was riding my mountain bike through the creek and you know, just always outdoors doing something. And I was always athletic, too, you know, in high school and college. I was involved in cross country and track. And after college, I did some backpacking trips with some friends and just immediately fell in love with it because it was kind of this perfect blend of combining the great outdoors with athletics. And so, you know, it started out as backpacking, and I kind of wanted to just take it up a notch. Like, backpacking was fun, but, you know, we can go harder, and this can get a lot more intense. And I didn't know anything about climbing. You know, I didn't know what kind of fitness level I'd needed. I didn't have any gear. I didn't have any training. So I was, you know, grew up on a small farm in Iowa. I'm completely green. I had no idea what I was doing. But
there are a few hills, but not a lot.
Yeah, we're not well known for our mountains here in Iowa. So,
no.
You know, so I really was kind of flying blind there early on, and just you know, trying to figure out how to get into it. And the first peak I ever climbed was in 2010, and I was actually heavily involved with a lot of volunteer work, and I was doing a project with an organization called American Hiking Society. And, you know, you partner with them, and then you'll go out and you'll either build brand new hiking trails or do maintenance on existing hiking trails and, you know, whatever the park needs you to do. So I signed up as a volunteer, and I was looking for, you know, I'd worked with them before, and so I knew that they ran a good program, and I was kind of scrolling through their options. I was looking for another program of theirs to do, and I found one in Inyo National Forest, which is where Mount Whitney is at in California. It's the highest peak in the lower 48, and so I was reading the project description, and it said, you know, you spend all week doing maintenance on existing trails, and then on the last day, Mount Whitney is right there, and you can take a run up the mountain with the park ranger that you've been working with all week. And I thought, oh, perfect. You know, I don't know how to climb a mountain, but I'll be with a ranger. So,
well, you know. I'm going to have you finish that story in just a moment.
Okay.
Jen Loeb is here. She is a mountain climber and humanitarian, the first Iowa woman to summit Mount Everest, and featured in the new book, Amazing Iowa Athletes, an A to Z illustrated guide to some of Iowa's most extraordinary athletes. Author Katie Swalwell is also here. The book has just been published by Raygun. This is Talk of Iowa from Iowa Public Radio. It's Talk of Iowa from Iowa Public Radio. I'm Charity Nebbe. My guests right now are Katie Swalwell. She is the author of Amazing Iowa Athletes, an A to Z illustrated guide to some of Iowa's most extraordinary athletes, which has just been published by Raygun. It's a children's book, but I'm sure people of many generations will enjoy it. And also with us is one of the athletes who's featured in the book, Jen Loeb. She's a mountain climber and humanitarian, the first Iowa woman to summit Mount Everest. And she's a seven summits seeker trying to climb all of the seven highest peaks in the world. She has one left, Vinson Massif in Antarctica. And Jen, just before the break, we left you on Mount Whitney. That was right. One of your first big climbs.
Right. So, you know, I flew out to California, and, you know, I was volunteering all week. And then the last day came around, and the park ranger's like, okay, you know, who wants to go climb Mount Whitney? And I'm like, I do. And, So we go up there, we take the mountaineer's route up the backside and make it to the summit. And I get up there, and you know, I had such a great time. But there's also this just element of trepidation and just, you know, it's not a technical route, but there are a couple of places where, you know, if you slip here, man, you're really going to fall and really going to get hurt. And that was very new to me. I hadn't, you know, I was kind of always a thrill seeker and always up for an adventure, but Just realizing that, you know, there's a real potential for a hazard here was kind of, it caught me off guard a little bit, and it was a little unnerving. And, you know, so I made it to the top, and I didn't have any problems with the altitude, which was another thing I had to figure out. You know, being a flatlander here in Iowa, I wasn't sure that I could even tolerate the altitude, but I didn't have any problems with that. So, you know, made it to the top and then got back down, and then, you know, got back to Iowa after the project was over. And, you know, as soon as you get home, you kind of forget the bad parts and the parts where you're like, oh, I was a little nervous there. Oh, you know, that was kind of scary. Or, oh, that was terrifying, you know. And you kind of conveniently forget those things. And you remember like, oh, man, that was so fun. And, wow, what an adrenaline rush. And I got to do that again. So, you know, I still
didn't. You were absolutely hooked.
Yeah, well, not. the hook was set, but I wasn't really reeled in yet. You know, so once I got back to Iowa, I was kind of looking for, like, what's the next thing? I still didn't have any training. I still didn't have any gear. Still had really no clue how to climb a mountain. So, you know, I started just doing some research on the internet and trying to figure out, like, what's the next thing I can do without gear and without training. And so I found Kilimanjaro. That looked like, you know, a possibility because it's not technical. I didn't need rope skills or ice axes and crampons and anything. It's really a hike, but at altitude, and it's much higher than Whitney. So I thought, you know, let's do that one and see if I can tolerate a higher altitude. And if I don't have any issues with the altitude, then I can take the next step. So I went over to Tanzania and did Kilimanjaro. I had a great time. Didn't have any issues with the altitude. And so I got back to the States and I thought, okay, you know I can physically do this. I know that I can tolerate the altitude and my fitness is strong enough. So let's take the next step. And now it's time to go to school and really learn how to do this. So I went to mountain climbing school. You know, I did some research and found a outfitter that was, you know, they trained people how to climb. And so I had a ton of gear that I needed to buy, which, you know, I can't get that here in Iowa. So I had to buy everything online. So I spent hours just sitting in front of the computer buying things online and flew out to Rainier and did a mountain climbing school course. It was kind of one of those situations where I didn't even realize, like, I didn't know how much I didn't know. And it was a little overwhelming. There's just so much going on, how to climb a mountain and how to live on a mountain and stay healthy while you're there. You know, things like rope travel on a glacier and crevasse rescue and self-arrest and just how to cook and, you know, take care of your tent and your food and yourself and stay healthy. So there were so many things I had to learn, but, you know, I had a good time out there. And then once I passed that course, then that allowed me to start signing up for other expeditions. So then I, you know, at that point, you know, I'm starting to get reeled in. I'm starting to kind of get sucked into this mountain climbing world. And I'm having a lot of fun. And so I started signing up for every expedition that I could possibly cram into my work schedule. And every time I went, you know, I'm learning something new. I'm getting more experience. I'm gaining more confidence. And I'm just having a blast. And, you know, at that point, then I was hooked. And I was like,
well,
okay.
And, you know, before we run out of time, I want to ask you, you never set out to be the first.
No.
Anything.
No.
But here you are, the first Iowa woman to summit Mount Everest. And of course, Katie put you in the front of her book. What does that feel like to have so many people looking at you and thinking about what you've accomplished?
Yeah, you know, when I started doing this, I really never did set out to be the first woman from Iowa to do anything. You know, I was just having fun and getting to travel the world and getting to challenge myself in ways that, you know, really forced me to be my best and give 110%. And that's, you know, I really love that when I'm forced to put my best foot forward. And so, you know, the fact that I was the first woman from Iowa, it's kind of, I don't know, it's a little, I don't know, you know, I'm just trying to live my life, you know, the best way and be the best version of myself. And so, you know, I think if I can use what I've done and my accomplishments and use that to inspire other people, then that gives what I've done even more meaning. You know, there's a lot of times where I'll do an Everest presentation for a group of kids, and when the presentation is done, man, they'll run up and they want high fives and they want selfies and they get so excited, and I love that because, you know, if I can inspire them to achieve their dreams, whatever they want to accomplish, man, that really, you know, that makes my heart happy. And that really, you know, puts an exclamation point on the meaning of everything I've done. I think in some ways that even means more to me than summiting a mountain, just the impact that I can have on other people.
Well, Jen, thank you so much for being part of this show today. And I know you are working on a book about your experiences. So soon we will talk a lot more about your experiences.
Awesome.
Jen Loeb is a mountain climber and humanitarian. She is also the first athlete profiled in the new book, Amazing Iowa Athletes, written by Katie Swalwell. And I want to bring another one of the athletes in the book into the conversation. And Katie, I'll let you do the same thing that you did last time. So Timothy LeDuc is going to join us in just a moment, along with his figure skating partner, Ashley Kane Gribble, who we will totally accept as a honorary Iowan because we're really good at that. Timothy LeDuc is a pairs figure skater who grew up in Cedar Rapids. He and Ashley Kane Gribble are having an incredible year. They are the 2019 U.S. Pairs National Champions and the 2019 World Team Trophy Champions. Katie, why did you decide that you wanted to profile Timothy?
Oh, I was so excited when I stumbled across his story. You know, a lot of the athletes, almost all of the athletes in the books, in the book, who I featured are people who are using sport for something beyond just competition. And I think Jen pointed this out, that it allowed her to travel the world and she's been able to engage in conservation efforts. And I think, you know, there's a lot of social movements and a lot of politics, frankly, that come out in sports. And something that really impressed me with Timothy is how he's using his platform as an openly gay athlete to talk about LGBTQ discrimination, to talk about his experiences. And I was just really impressed and inspired because a lot of professional athletes or athletes at his level are not out. And I think hopefully he'll speak to that a little bit because I think that's a really just beautiful part of his story. His partner, too, when I've seen them interviewed and read a lot about them, that she's very tall. And I think that she, you know, our bodies, our physical bodies go through a lot in this world, and people can discriminate or make stereotypes or have biases for all sorts of reasons for who we are as people. And I think that many of these athletes have been part of movements and speaking up and out about ways that we can do right by each other and build a better world. And so those stories, I think, were really exceptional to me and stood out. I was excited about
All right. Well, let's bring both Timothy and Ashley into the conversation. Hello.
Hi, Charity and Katie.
Hello.
Hi, we're happy speaking with you.
Oh, it's wonderful to hear from both of you. Where are you today?
We're at our home rink in Euless, Texas. We have a competition in a couple of weeks, so we're just preparing for that.
Oh, very exciting. And Timothy, let me ask you, when did you learn that you were going to be part of this book?
So Katie emailed me a couple of weeks ago, and I was overjoyed when I heard about it. I thought, what an honor to be included in such a cool project published by Raygun. And, you know, we just heard from Jen, and hearing her story is just so inspiring. So I'm really, really honored to be part of this.
And have you seen the illustration?
I have. It's fantastic. And how cool that they're including artists from Iowa as well. So this is really, you know, a piece of art produced all in Iowa. It's really special.
Absolutely. Well, the illustration is very cool. I mean, it looks like you, and it's overlaid with some rainbow colors and shapes. And it's really a beautiful illustration. And Tim, I know that you and I have talked in the past about what it meant for you to come out as an athlete, which was a really difficult process for you and really put you in some situations that, of course, you didn't want to be in. But it was so important for you to be openly gay. Why? Tell us just briefly again why that was such an important step for you to take, even though it cost you a great deal.
Certainly. So Katie spoke earlier about trying to help the future generation of athletes see themselves represented with this book. And I just, that resonates so much with me, because when I was growing up and really just starting in the sport, I really didn't have any beacons, and I didn't see myself represented very much. And things have started to change, and LGBT characters are starting to be featured in a lot more media. So we're starting to change the culture. There's starting to be more visibility. But when I was growing up, I really didn't have those things. And I spent so much time self-deprecating and tearing myself down, because I didn't understand that there was nothing wrong with me. I didn't have anyone to tell me that. So now that I have been really fortunate enough to, Ashley and I have been fortunate enough to progress in the sport, and I have this platform and this ability to speak to the next generation, I want to use it to say, hey, you can reach this point. You can become national champion. You can become world team trophy champion. And you can do it all while being authentic and not having to change anything about yourself. So visibility is super important. It's something that we can do to change the culture and create a community of likeness. And, you know, when we do those things, when we put in the work to start changing the culture, that community of likeness helps make us stronger. That's also only half the piece as well. So I advocate for queer liberation, which is visibility plus policy. So while I use my platform for visibility, I also advocate for policies that help change really discriminatory actions that still take place, you know, queer people being fired from their jobs or denied housing. So together with visibility and policy, I advocate for queer liberation. And I'm just really, really honored to be able to do that with my platform, and to extend that now with this book is really cool.
Well, and the two of you are skating so beautifully. And of course, the eyes of the world are on you right now. And both of you have chosen, as Katie was just saying, chosen to be really open about some of your personal struggles and your personal stories to make life easier for others. Ashley, I have such a hard time understanding how people have been so cruel to you over the years about your body, but as an elite athlete, you have been criticized in so many ways for being bigger than whatever the stereotype or the ideal idea of what a figure skater should be, and you've used this platform for that as well. I want to ask you both, though, because you've had such an amazing year. Tell me about your training right now, how you're feeling, and what the next competition is. Ashley, why don't you give us a little bit of a rundown?
Yeah, certainly. Well, thank you so much. You know, I've had to go through a lot of body changes on the world stage. People had to see me go through my teenage years and now obviously in my 20s. And my body's constantly evolving. So I had to do that on the world stage. And sometimes it created a little bit of a negative effect in my mind, because I took what other people said about my body into effect and saw myself in their eyes. And over the years, I developed this like tough skin about it, but I'm very comfortable with my body. It's what won us the national title. It's what gets me through training every single day. And instead of looking at my body as a negative thing, I look at it as a strength now. And if I can be a beacon for somebody that was questioning if their body is able to do this sport, I hope that they can look at me and see that we don't all have to look the same and physically, and we can go out there and do what we're passionate about. But I just wanted to say that really quickly.
Yeah. Thank you.
But obviously next for us is the Greb Croatia. We have a competition called Golden Spin, and that'll be the first week of December. But this week we have a show in Nashville, and then we also have a show in New York City in December, and two shows here in Dallas. So it's been a really exciting time, and we're obviously leading up to Nationals. That'll be in January. So it's very busy for us.
Absolutely. And how are you feeling?
Awesome. We're really excited. You know, this new season has been great for us, because we now are the national champions. We carry that title with us. And now we're kind of navigating how to use that title and to continue to progress as a team. So we're really looking forward to Nationals in January. We're looking to defend our title and to make the world team again.
Well, that's awesome. And Ashley, I know last year you had an amazing comeback from a terrible concussion. I hope that you do not have any kind of amazing comeback story this year, as gripping as they are. Please stay healthy and strong, both of you.
Oh, thank you. Actually, the place that we're going for the competition in Croatia, it'll be the one-year anniversary in the same place, same competition.
Wow.
So we're hoping to have a much more positive outcome. But I think if we just put all of our training forward and just keep our heads down, and we'll be totally fine.
Well, best of luck, and we will be watching. Thank you both for talking with us today.
Thank you so much.
Timothy LeDuc and Ashley Kane Gribble, they are the 2019 national champions in U.S. pairs figure skating, the 2019 World Team Trophy champions as well. And Timothy LeDuc grew up in Cedar Rapids. He's featured in the new book, Amazing Iowa Athletes, by Katie Swalwell. And Katie, we've got 30 seconds left. Of course, this was just published by Ray Gunn, and it's exciting to see it go out into the world. What are you most excited about in thinking about families sharing this book?
Yeah, I think just trying to hook a new group of people who may not think that they're interested in history, to get them connected and get them thinking about these issues, like Timothy said, not just visibility, but also the history of structures and laws and policies that have kept some people out of playing certain sports. I think that inspires us, again, to really try to make our world a better place. So I hope people go out. It's available on Ray Gunn's website and in all Ray Gunn stores and local independent bookstores.
All right, Katie Swalwell, thank you so much.
Thank you, Charity. Appreciate it.
Katie Swalwell is author of Amazing Iowa Athletes, an A to Z illustrated guide to some of Iowa's most extraordinary athletes. It has just been published by Ray Gunn. This is Talk of Iowa from Iowa Public Radio.
Support for IPR and this podcast comes from Central College and Humanities Iowa, presenting the new podcast, Mid-Americana, Stories from a Changing Midwest. New episodes from Season 1 are available at midamericana.com or wherever podcasts are found.
It's Talk of Iowa from Iowa Public Radio. I'm Charity Nebbe. Earlier this year, Ambassador Kenneth Quinn, who's been the president of the World Food Prize Organization for the last 20 years, announced that he's stepping down. The World Food Prize was founded in 1986 by Norman Borlaug, renowned plant scientists from Iowa who received the Nobel Peace Prize for creating disease-resistant wheat, a development that's credited with saving a billion lives. Borlaug founded the prize to honor those whose research and work helps to fight hunger on a global scale. In the 20 years that Ambassador Quinn has led the organization, he's taken it from being an annual award to becoming a three-day internationally attended academic symposium in Iowa. He leaves big shoes to fill, and we recently learned that Barbara Stinson will be filling those shoes. She brings with her more than 30 years of experience in environmental public policy and business management, focusing for the last 10 years on global food security and food safety, and she is with me now. Barbara Stinson, welcome to the show.
Thank you so much, Charity. I'm glad to be here.
Well, and congratulations. You have done so much in your life. We're going to talk a little bit about the experiences that you bring to this job, but also tell me when you learned about the World Food Prize. What does this mean to you?
Well, I have to say, I learned about the Food Prize, it must be over 20 years ago, when I first became familiar with the work of Norman Borlaug. I was working in Mexico City, outside of Mexico City, in the area where he conducted his research. And I was working with one of the CG institutions that supported him, and he helped support as well. CIMMYT, they do maize and wheat research and all kinds of activity. And he was visiting the campus at a time where I was conducting strategic planning for CIMMYT. So I almost had the opportunity to meet him. We missed each other by 2 days. And that's when I really began to understand the tremendous legacy, all the research and work that he's done, and of course, his Nobel Prize laureate.
Yeah. Well, let's talk about you. You've had a really interesting career in really the global food and global health. So let's go back in time and tell me how you got your start.
I started with work in undergraduate school on issues of environmental conservation and management as a neutral third party. I had the opportunity to serve in an internship with a mediation organization, and I realized that this methodology of trying to address complex disputes was a tremendous addition to society's decision-making processes. So I studied mediation and facilitation in college and at the University of Colorado in Boulder. I had this tremendous internship that introduced me into the field, and I immediately found that this is the work I wanted to do for the rest of my career, and continued then to study and explore how to bring this collaborative decision-making process into the mainstream.
So you fell in love with the idea of helping people or organizations, sides, different sides of an issue, listen to each other, hear each other, and come to some kind of compromise?
That's correct. It really does start with the listening. It starts with convening a process whereby people can bring their information, their concerns, their fears about the future together to deliberate on them. And the real work is in determining possible solutions in a joint fashion. And when you do that and try to not only focus on the facts or focus on areas of difference, but you really get to know each other as people, then people tend to, over time, try to make better decisions, create solutions that not only address each other's interests, but are really much more in the interest of the environment or society or whatever issues you are trying to serve.
This work led you to co-found the Meridian Institute, which is a mediation firm with offices in Denver and Washington, D.C. And at that firm, as a part of Meridian, you helped to lead an effort to control the spread of aflatoxin in food and feed in Africa. Tell me a little bit more about that project. And first, for people who don't know, what is aflatoxin?
Aflatoxin is a terrible toxin contamination that grows in food, and it grows in staple crops primarily in tropical areas. So as it happens in many of the developing countries in the world are in tropical areas, and aflatoxin is a poison that grows in very important value chains and staple crops that these people depend on every day. So aflatoxin is probably the most carcinogenic naturally occurring substance that we know of. You can't taste it, you can't smell it, you can't discern it really in any way from any other fungus that is growing in food. So people are ingesting it in high volumes on a regular basis. They don't even know that they're consuming poison, and it's accumulating their bodies and slowly poisoning them. Sometimes over time diminishes brain function, stunts children, is considered to be possibly stunting children all over the world. So aflatoxin is a scourge in our society, and it's a problem that has been largely dealt with in developed countries, but not in developing countries.
So help me understand what you were able to do as part of Meridian. I can think about, you know, non-governmental organizations and health policy organizations and things like that trying to get involved in this. But what role did you play as a mediation firm in helping to stop the spread?
Meridian Institute evolved not only to be a mediation and facilitation organization, but really a collaborative problem-solving and decision-making organization. And I, in particular, was interested in collaborative planning. How do you plan for a better future in a manner that involves all stakeholders in the planning process before there's a tremendous dispute, a legal battle, a court decision looming? And so Meridian was a very strong base for funders to come to us and ask for our help in assessing this problem of aflatoxin, particularly in Africa. So we consulted with stakeholders, over 200 stakeholders from every perspective, and we assembled their advice for how to manage aflatoxin and reduce its health impacts and its impacts on agriculture from the continental level, at the national level, in many of the most affected countries in Africa, and even at the local level and with smallholder farmers, getting them information and resources and tools that they needed to manage aflatoxin.
Your role as a nonprofit without your bottom line on the line, did that allow you to communicate with people on both the production end, the receiving end? Did that allow you to communicate with people in a different way that maybe a corporation can't?
It really did in this instance. Meridian Institute was well-respected already by this time. We'd been around for probably 13 years already, and we were considered to be a neutral platform, a trusted party that would convene activities and plans and execute projects in a fair basis from perspective of all parties. So that's really one of the great commonalities between Meridian Institute and the World Food Prize Foundation. The World Food Prize Foundation has always been a bipartisan effort. Ambassador Quinn placed it carefully in that terrain in order to allow all actors to come together and work together on behalf of a greater global good, which is addressing food insecurity.
You have become really interested in and committed to working to alleviate global food insecurity. What happened? Was there an experience that you had that made you want to change your focus?
Honestly, there were so many experiences accumulating as my career developed. I decided at a certain point that I'd been working domestically a lot, and there were such important global hunger issues outside of the U.S. that I wanted to focus on. And I wanted to take my domestic agriculture experience abroad to try to really give the institutions that were trying to work on these terrible problems in Africa potentially the benefit of some of the collaborative decision-making techniques that we had developed in order to try to better address some of the issues they were facing, particularly around aflatoxin contamination, where countries really disagreed about best ways to address it. It was difficult to get information into farmers' hands about the problems of aflatoxin, the potential impacts, and the management techniques that could be used. And by participating in a process together towards that decision, we could perhaps introduce this methodology to them and have more impacts more quickly.
In that work, in your focus on food insecurity, how did that bring you into interactions with the World Food Prize Foundation?
Well, the area of work it directly overlaps. Food safety, this is a food safety matter, aflatoxin. There is no food security without safe food. So it doesn't matter how much you generate. If it's toxic, it's not going to feed the world. So I've been working in the context of the same agricultural development issues that the World Food Prize Foundation has been trying to address all these years. And really, the institutions that operate on these matters all over the world and that are partners with the World Food Prize Foundation are similar. The research that goes on, the activities that are in focus on a month-to-month basis are really very congruent. And working in Africa was Norman Borlaug's final frontier. He really saw the ongoing problems of food insecurity, malnutrition, poverty in Africa. And I think, you know, at the close of his career, he said these must be addressed in Africa as well as the rest of the world.
As I mentioned earlier, Ambassador Quinn has really turned the World Food Prize Symposium into something that draws people from all over the world. They get together in Des Moines for 3 days, and there's such an exchange of information and ideas and research. What are you most excited about as president of the World Food Prize?
I'm excited because the platform of the World Food Prize Foundation is so substantial, not only in the dialogues, which have grown, and they're a tremendous reach and a tremendous platform for discussions on the most pressing issues. The prize award itself brings recognition to the important research that really is advancing these issues. But the youth programs that have grown tremendously over the last number of years are amazing in scope and reach. They are addressing kids and giving the opportunity for kids to become educated and participate in important discussions on food security issues from high school age through college and even postgraduate placements, as well as, you know, potential jobs. And so I think growing the next generation is of agricultural folks committed to agriculture and from many perspectives. I think that is a crucial mission of the foundation and one of the great frontiers ahead for growth.
There is also a lot of controversy involved in feeding the world, and we see now protesters really at every World Food Prize symposium and outside the Capitol when the food prize is announced. We see a rift in how people think that we should be feeding the world. And, you know, of course, there is controversy over genetically modified organisms and use of pesticides and large corporations and all of these different voices. Now, your experience as a mediator, I can imagine, could be incredibly valuable in tackling some of these issues. What do you see as maybe the greatest challenge that you may be able to make a difference in?
Well, let me say that with regard to the controversy around feeding the world, it's absolutely true. In any critical issue where there's problems to solve, there are always different points of view. And one of the jobs of the foundation is to welcome in those points of view, to be open to all perspectives, to present those on the stage of the dialogues and represent them in really all the programming, and to try to make advancements on those differences and on the issues themselves. So I think it is one of the great challenges that I'll be taking on to try to continue that. I hope that my background in collaborative decision-making will be useful. I think the board and many of the partners that were involved did think that my career in particular could lend a helpful lens to all of the future decisions and future directions of the foundation because of that background.
This job is also leading you to move to Iowa in the middle of winter?
Yes. I know. I can tell you, my husband and I are excited to be moving to Iowa, even in January. I think we know what we're getting into. We've lived in Colorado for 30 years. It's been wonderful. But we have a very strong Iowa connection already. There's a strong Colorado-Iowa connection in general, it seems. But we've met wonderful people here. And, of course, I'm feeling so honored to not only assume this position, but I'm feeling so welcomed into Iowa. So we're very much looking forward to getting to know the community better and the entire state of Iowa and many of the wonderful stakeholders and partners that are here, and extending the reach and impact of the World Food Prize Foundation in Iowa as well.
Well, congratulations, Barbara. It's lovely to meet you, and I'm sure we'll have many opportunities to talk again.
I certainly hope so. Thank you so much, Charity.
Barbara Stinson is the new president of the World Food Prize. She will be fulfilling that role beginning in January as Ambassador Kenneth Quinn, who has led the organization for the last 20 years, steps down. Talk of Iowa is a production of Iowa Public Radio. Our producers are Rick Brewer, Matt Alvarez, Caitlin Harrop, and Dennis Reese. I'm Charity Nebbe. This is Talk of Iowa.